there are thousands of missing person cases nationwide, as well as thousands of unidentified human remains in the offices of the nation's medical examiners and coroners. And joining us to talk about how missing persons cases are managed and how forensic scientists and researchers work to identify human remains and help bring closure to families and loved ones, our forensic anthropologist and professor of biology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, and Cincinnati Police Detective Jason Hodge. You can join our conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Beth and Jason, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Jason, how many missing person cases are there in Cincinnati?
Well, on average, we have approximately 1,200 cases per year.
That many?
Yes, sir.
How does the Cincinnati Police Department define a missing person?
Well, there's a there's an age criteria in which we enter them in. All criteria, all critical and non-critical missing individuals between ages 20 and under. We have critical missing and non-critical missing of 65 years of age and older, and 21 years and 64 years of age is a middle of the range that we add into our system as missing persons.
Is there a certain amount of time somebody has to be missing before they fall into this category?
There is not. Now, there's a I think the TV has kind of confused people about a 24-hour missing period, and that's simply not true. If we believe that that person is a suspect of foul play, or they just believe that individual is missing or in danger, we can enter the person.
So it's based more on circumstances then than
absolutely.
It is time.
Yes.
You were saying 1,200 a year. On average, how many are still missing usually after a year?
Out of that 1,200 number, that includes our runaways that are considered missing as well. So it's a fluctuating number throughout the year. I couldn't really tell you exactly what that number would be.
So once it becomes a missing person case, Jason, what where does it go next? What's the next step?
Initially, what happens is obviously the uniform officer will get a call. They will respond to the address. They will identify if this individual is a missing person. They have a 2-hour requirement for us to get that information entered into the National Crime Information Computer, the nationwide database. What will happen is at our district level, there's investigators that will handle the cases for 7 days. Once those cases are past the 7-day period, it'll come to my office at that point where I will continue to follow through on leads, follow up on any information that the initial investigator has followed up on. And then at that point, once I run out of leads, I'll enter into NAMIS.
Now, what exactly is NAMIS? What's that abbreviation?
NAMIS is the National Missing and Unidentified Persons Program.
It's a database.
Yes, it is. Yes.
How many nationally are reported missing?
Nationally, the FBI statistics show that there's 634,908 people missing a year.
That many?
Yes, sir.
And Beth, what about statewide? How does the state of Ohio fit in?
Well, my affiliation is with the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. And so in Ohio, there are a total of 611 missing person cases in NAMIS, in the national database that's run by the National Institutes of Justice. Kentucky has 335 and Indiana has 262.
I'm amazed by the number of cases. Is this something that is it growing every year?
Personally, in terms of NAMIS, I hope it does grow because there's a problem of a lack of awareness sometimes of where to go for resources. And because NAMIS is run by the federal government, there's a lot of free resources that people can get, whether they're missing a loved one, whether it's a law enforcement agency that wants resources such as DNA testing, that sort of thing, of family members. I work primarily on the dead side of the equation. NAMIS is a series of two sister databases, one where the unidentified remains information is entered by coroners, and the other where missing persons information is entered by either law enforcement or the general public. And then algorithms allow the systems to query one another. And as I say with NAMIS, there are no happy endings. There are just endings, because if a match is made, then it means the individual is deceased.
And so you're saying that, that there are a lot of cases that we don't even know about. So the numbers that we're seeing in NamUs are just tip of the iceberg kind of thing.
Just a fraction. The phrase that's often used regarding the unidentified persons is the nation's silent mass disaster, because it's estimated that 40,000 John, Jane, and Baby Doe cases exist in the United States. Now, some of them are skeletons in a box in a medical examiner's office. Others, the remains have been cremated and they're only paper records at this time. But that's since 1950 alone.
Mm-hmm. That 1,200 a year that you're citing, Jason, has that number gone up over the years as well?
That's our average number. That's an average over several years of us keeping data on the information.
Yeah. A lot of the cases are unsolved, but for the ones that are solved, is there like a typical time frame? How long does it usually take?
There's not a typical time frame for missing persons. It's something that can take one day. It's something that can take several years. We have missing cases that are as old as 25 years.
Beth, one of the challenges that investigators face in trying to resolve either unidentified remains or a missing persons case, what are the obstacles?
Well, I think if you looked at the missing and unidentified databases and you took a snapshot of them, if they truly represent the universe of unidentified and missing persons cases, then the demographics between the two sides should line up. And they don't, which tells us there are either a lot of unidentified individuals whose remains we have not found, or there are missing persons who are voluntarily missing and don't want to be found. So some of the challenges are getting family members to the right resources so they can have DNA testing, allowing skeletal remains to be examined by forensic anthropologists like myself so we can, assess who this individual might be biologically. And also just, as I said before, raising awareness of the problems and who to go to if you need help with a missing case. Or even for a coroner's agency, where do I go if I need help with an unidentified case?
Now, in the cases that you've worked on, Beth, is there an average length of time the remains have not been identified? And what's the oldest case that you've ever dealt
with? I had one where the young woman was missing for 38 years and we got her identified. And that took a lot of resources. It took an interest on the part of the local sheriff's office. So it can be, usually cases are not submitted to NamUs until after local resources have been exhausted and the agency maybe doesn't know where to turn. But because of the free DNA testing that NamUs will do, there are also agencies that enter individuals in right away. And, one would think that with the internet today and the communication networks, we wouldn't have cases where remains continue to be unidentified after a long time, but it still happens all the time.
Yeah, I would think that with all the technology we have, it would be easier, but it's not a whole lot easier than it was in the past.
Well, you also have to consider that transportation networks make it easier for someone to be across the country in, a matter of hours or days. So the technology has both improved the situation and also complicated the situation.
I think what's important also to note is the fact that a lot of people are concerned about providing their DNA. For one thing, people have to understand that the DNA is not run through a criminal database. That DNA we will keep on file until that individual is found or identified, and if once that happens, that DNA is destroyed. It never gets run through any of our criminal databases and matched with. For example, we're looking for somebody for a burglary or something, and a lot of people have that concern, and we find that sometimes that causes a problem with people providing DNA for us to help identify some of the identified persons.
How tough is this, Jason? I mean, how painstaking is the work that you do?
It's difficult. You run into a lot of dead ends. It takes a lot of time, a lot of resources.
How does it compare to what you see on TV?
We spend a lot of time as police officers debunking a lot of things that people see on TV.
So like you brought up earlier, how there's the idea that you have to be gone for 24 hours before
right.
you can be reported
right.
missing.
Right.
But what are some other differences?
Well, I guess some people believe that you have to like anybody can report a missing person, which is correct. It you have to be an adult, obviously, over 18 years of age to report a missing person. Some people think, well, I can, you know, if I'm 17, I can report, you know, my parents missing. Well, unfortunately, in the way the law works, that's not available at this time.
And what about the differences between children and adults? We were talking about that before the show.
The children's cases are obviously they're pretty hard as well. You have a lot of times where we've had cases where parents will wait several days and then report their child missing. Well, that puts us behind the power curve considerably with the resources that we can use to pull together to try to locate children. It's difficult when we get to the point where we have to enter a child into NAMIS simply by showing that, you know, we ran out of all our leads. I mean, it makes it very difficult to do. The adults, a lot of times we have, like Beth was explaining, we have adults that they disappear and they just want to disappear. They don't want to be found. We've found people in other states that said, I'm not missing. Here I am. I just don't want anybody to know where I'm at, and I want to live a different life now. And so we run into that quite often as well.
I had a case involving that with NAMIS, and what the law enforcement agency did was they made the individual come in and prove his identity, and then they had to unfortunately tell his wife that he was alive and well, he just didn't want to be married anymore. And so, you know, everyone has a right to their privacy, and so in that case they weren't able to, you know, connect the couple, but they were able to remove him from the database.
Now, how do you get involved with a case? And of course, in Jason's case, somebody's reported it. How do you become involved?
Well, I've been a forensic anthropologist since the late 1980s. I sometimes say I was forensic before it was cool. And because most of the cases involving unidentified remains are cases involving skeletons or decomposed individuals where, you know, the typical markers of what hair color, eye color, skin color, tattoos, the surface features like fingerprints, when those are all gone, very often it's a dental identification, or a forensic anthropologist will come in and help assess whether that person is white, black, Native American, about how old they were, because then with the demographics in place, law enforcement officials can know which missing person cases to pull for comparison, for example, and which family members we may want to submit DNA samples. And in 2009, I was asked to be part of the Forensic Sciences Services team for NAMIS, and we helped not only refine the system and how it worked, but provide expertise as the system was developed. And so in that capacity, I wound up, now I manage 35 cold cases of unidentified remains in Ohio, and that's about 40% of the cases in Ohio. So for me, the biggest challenge is finding time to work all of these cases.
And we'll continue our conversation about missing persons cases, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss how missing persons cases are managed and how forensic scientists and researchers work to identify human remains are forensic anthropologist and professor of biology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, and Cincinnati Police Detective Jason Hodge. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Beth, can you give us an example of a case that's been resolved?
One of the first matches that was ever made using the NAMIS system was from the tri-state area. In August of 1987, a 21-year-old woman named Paula Davis went missing out of Kansas City, Missouri. And then 14 hours later, in Montgomery County, Ohio, the Dayton area, the body of a white female was found. But no one made the connection, and so both of those cases went unsolved until October of 2009, when a young woman was watching a public service announcement on television about NAMIS. And she went straight to her computer, and she was easily able to enter in some search parameters involving her sister, you know, the age, when she was last known alive, that sort of thing. And then the clincher, well, she got 10 cases came up in the, you know, in the list, and she went through all 10 of them, and the very last one, she saw that young woman had a tattoo of a unicorn and a tattoo of a rose, and she knew it was her sister. And I believe it's I-70 that directly connects Kansas City with the Dayton, Ohio area, but for all of those years, no one had made the connection.
So that's a resolved case. What about an example of an unresolved case?
I think the one that haunts me the most is a case that tri-state area citizens might know something about. It's called the Buckskin Girl. She was found in April of 1981, and she was probably found within hours after she died. So she had a face. She had, you know, eye color, hair color, everything that you could want in a case in terms of identifiable features. Age 18 to 26. And she had this very unique handmade buckskin jacket on, and her hair was in pigtails, you know, actual braids on either side. And so that case has haunted me and investigators from Miami County for many years now. We've recently done some more high-tech studies like a pollen analysis on her clothing, and we're doing stable isotope testing on her hair right now as well, just to try to figure out why wouldn't someone be looking for this young woman. And it was interesting in her case, too, because she had perfect teeth, not a cavity, not a filling, except she had a cap on one of her front teeth. And that would suggest to me that probably a chipped tooth in childhood, and somebody had enough resources to get that tooth capped. So here we have this person who had good dental care, and yet no one is missing her. So it's just really very curious.
Well, the case has just started to get some national attention and to heat up somewhat. What's drawing attention to it right now?
I think we just had an anniversary. It was April 24th in 1981 that she was found. So we just had a big anniversary there, and that's when they announced the results of the pollen analysis. And it suggests that this young woman was from the Northeast. The pollen on her clothing suggested she was from the Northeast. And there was also minute amounts of pollen that suggested she had recently been in the Southwest. So maybe she was traveling between the Northeastern states and the Southwest when, you know, something happened on her way home.
Now, this happened more than three decades ago. How likely is it that someone might step forward at this point? Have you ever seen that happen before?
Yes. As I said before, the longest I've had a case resolved was 38 years, and the family had never given up looking for this young woman. It was just a series of unfortunate circumstances in that case. And then the other thing that Jason mentioned is, you know, adults have a right to go missing, and sometimes I think that unless there's a real suspicion of foul play, you know, the resources aren't necessarily put towards adults the way they might be with children, because people have a right to go as they wish. And this young girl that was her case was resolved after 38 years, she was over 18 years of age. So the police said, you know, she has a right to go where she wants to go.
Jason, how hard is it to get people to step forward and give information in cases like this?
Generally, it's not too difficult with family members. We have a lot of cases where family members are still actively involved in their missing loved ones. Now, when we have cases where they're involving just maybe friends or coworkers reporting somebody missing, and we can't locate family over time, those cases seem to kind of die out with the help from their friends. They've pretty much given us all their information that they have. A lot of times, they really don't know a lot more than what they've been told as a coworker. So we do have difficulty a lot of times with a lot of our cases getting additional information.
And Beth, in your case, how likely are you to get involved in something where an unidentified body is found locally, or does the coroner handle that kind of thing usually?
When remains are found, the coroner has to be called in. But in my consulting work, I contract with local agencies, and there's 88 counties in Ohio, and I think between my affiliations with Butler County, Montgomery County, and Hamilton County, those agencies cover about half of the state in terms of their contracts. So my work sphere is, you know, the whole southern half of Ohio, essentially. But my NamUs cases go throughout the state. Some of them I manage for agencies where the coroner's office doesn't have the personnel or the experience or the interest to manage a case from the 1970s, for example. We've had exhumations in cases where we've exhumed remains to get DNA testing done. That was the case in the Dark County case I mentioned, where we got the young woman identified after 38 years. That was because we had her exhumed and took DNA samples from the remains. So the cases are very complicated. I think some of the cases, and alluding to things that Jason was talking about, where people kind of give up or no one's looking anymore, it seems that there's a lot of individuals in NamUs, unidentified remains that may reflect homeless persons, persons of low socioeconomic status who were already estranged from their families. So, you know, people gave up looking for them maybe years before they went missing. Or a social services agency might know something about a person, but not enough to really give a full report to law enforcement. They just stopped showing up to, you know, the agency or what have you.
What can people do to help resolve these cases? What's some advice you would have for solving these? What can the public do?
I would say cooperate with the police. I mean, if we need information, you know, by all means, please give us the information. I mean, we have our Crime Stoppers number. You know, we have social media, districts, and just your patrol officers that are in the area. Provide as much information as you can. I mean, we look for tips. When tips come in, as far-fetched as that tip may be, we'll still follow it because you never know.
And as Jason said, family members, when they do come forward, it's very important to be willing to submit their DNA as a reference sample. And it goes into the national database, but as Jason mentioned, it's only compared to unidentified remains, so that people should not fear that, you know, if they submit DNA for a family member, that that's going to open some kind of a police investigation into some other potentially related crime. And also, you know, they can visit www.namus.gov. It's a free, publicly accessible website. So we have, you know, student clubs and organizations at universities that get involved in what we call cyber sleuthing. They can help look at these cases. They can put in the time that it takes to really get a match.
So an individual can put data in NamUs. Doesn't have to go through an agency?
Well, yes and no. If a family member is missing a loved one, they can start a NamUs profile, but then they would have to contact law enforcement, and it must be verified that there is an active missing persons case so that, you know, we don't have one fraternity buddy putting his friend in or something like that.
As a joke.
Right. So the cases are verified, and then that allows law enforcement to get the resources that NamUs has to offer as well.
Yeah, there are several other sites out there with information on missing persons. Are those legit, or should people be wary?
Some of them have very dedicated groups of volunteers. A lot of times they will visit other databases to get their cases. You know, I mean, they will take cases from NamUs and put them in their own local databases, which is fine. Anything that'll get the word out there. But I think, you know, then going through law enforcement, going through legitimate sites like NamUs, that's really the way to go. There's no harm in those other sites as long as they're, you know, doing good work.
We were talking about earlier about how TV portrays this business. One thing I noticed, CSI seemed to generate a lot of interest among students in going into forensic science. So I'm just wondering, as more students go into forensic science, is that going to help in solving a lot of these cases?
Well, I think we certainly need more individuals interested in the hard sciences. You know, I always say forensic is the adjective, science is the noun. So the way to go is to get a background in science. So for DNA technology, for drug analysis, for toxicology of, you know, drugs in body fluids or poisons, those are big areas where students can get involved. As far as forensic anthropology, there's really not, you know, I've been been in this business, as I said, since the 1980s, and I may only have 6 cases a year. And that's one of the reasons that I've used some of my extra time to go into this problem of resolving cold cases of unidentified remains.
But how important is the work that each of you do to the families and loved ones of these missing people?
Well, I mean, I always say that I'm just a piece in a bigger puzzle. It's the law enforcement officers that really do the work to solve the cases.
I think as long as we maintain contact with the families, they understand that we do care about their missing loved one. It's important for them to understand that we simply aren't going to stop investigating it. We're going to keep going until we can hopefully bring some resolution to it.
And is there a sense of closure when you finally do resolve a case for them? Do you get the sense from them that they're relieved? And
I think when it's like Beth said, the term closure isn't exactly the right term to use, especially if this is something that goes towards NamUs. But when we do have positive endings and you know, we've located somebody and they're fine and they're healthy, absolutely, I think that's a great feeling for the family. You know, they're very thankful that we keep in contact with them, that we just don't, you know, as officers change assignments, we move around and sometimes cases get shuffled off to another detective. It's important that they know that they're still in the forefront of our mind with their cases, and you know, we let them know that we're still holding on to it and we're still looking, and you know, and that type of closure when we find them healthy and well, that's good closure for us and the family.
Well, Beth and Jason, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Forensic anthropologist and professor of biology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, and Cincinnati Police Detective Jason Hodge. Coming up, we will hear about haircuts from the heart and, in Focus on Technology, the secret conversations of plants. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.